The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Why would someone return to the fairways after a 32-year absence? To find out, you'll want to read The Downhill Lie, Carl Hiaasen's hilarious confessional. As Hiaasen writes, "What possesses a man to return in midlife to a game at which he'd never excelled in his prime, and which in fact had dealt him mostly failure, angst, and exasperation? Here's why I did it. I'm one sick bastard." But there must be a longer explanation. I'm sure there is. Carl Hiaasen joined the Miami Herald as a general assignment reporter in 1976 and went on to work for the newspaper's weekly magazine and prize-winning investigations team. He's a three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee, and he's written over 1,300 pieces for the Miami Herald. It's probably up to 1,350 by now, exposing land corruption, scams, drug smuggling rings, dangerous doctors, and corrupt politicians. His columns have, at one time or another, and I have verification of this, pissed off just about everybody in South Florida, including his own bosses. For his journalism and commentary, Hiaasen received the Damon Runyon Award from the Denver Press Club. Janet Maslin of the New York Times has compared him to Preston Sturges, Woody Allen, and S.J. Perelman. It's pretty high praise, and he's a pretty funny guy. He's also the author of many novels, including Basket Case, Sick Puppy, Tourist Season, and Striptease, which, as you know, was made into a feature film. He's also the author of two novels for young readers, the newly released Flush and Hoot, which was awarded a Newbery Honor. He's also responsible for Team Rodent, an unsparing rant against the Disney empire and its grip on American culture. In conversation with Carl tonight is Chris Dufresne, who's an award-winning sports writer for the LA Times. He's presently the paper's National College football columnist, but he continues to report on a variety of topics ranging from Olympic alpine skiing to U.S. Open golf. And once, apparently, when LA actually supported professional football, he covered the Rams, Raiders, and the short-lived, but he writes, ill-advised Express of the now and forever defunct U.S. Football League. So, without further ado, please welcome Carl Hiaasen and Chris Dufresne to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Okay, I guess we got to bring these forward.
Still moving.
Still moving. Okay. Well, I guess you know the first question is why.
Why?
You know, is why 32 years without playing, and you decide to take it up again?
Yeah, I mean, I was perfectly happy and content for all those 32 years, and I guess. I'd started playing when I was a kid, playing golf with my dad, and the main reason, I had two reasons. Number one was to spend more time with my father, which I think is a lot reason a lot of folks play golf. Number two was to get out of church on Sunday, to get out of Mass. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and my mom insisted we go to catechism on Saturday and Mass on Sunday, and that was my whole weekend. And so I figured... If Dad took me golfing with him, I don't have to go to Mass. And I figure, so how hard can golf be? I'll just learn to play golf and go with my dad, and then God is paying me back for that now. So what happened was I didn't play for all this time, and then some old high school friends, the same guys I played with when I was a kid, kind of talked me into trying it again, and I got this middle-aged idea that. Because the new technology, you know, they've got all this fancy new technology in golf now, and I thought, well, maybe I can actually, maybe this is one thing I can do better in my 50s than I could when I was 20. And you guys out there know what I'm talking about. When you hit your 50s, you're on that proverbial back nine anyway. So, but there were plenty of guys my age who were playing pretty good golf, and I got it into my head that maybe I could get to that level, which was insane, but.
Well, I mean, there's an underlying theme in this book that you capture. It's just, and it's hard to explain to people, unless you play,
yeah,
how hard it is, because you watch TV and Tiger Woods, and these guys make it look so easy, and you think, well, you know, how hard can it be?
Yeah, it's an exceptionally difficult thing, and whether you want to call it a sport or a recreation, some people get mad when you call it a sport. Some guy said to me the other day in an interview, he said, anything you can drink beer and smoke a cigar while you're doing it, it isn't a sport. whatever it is, it's a ridiculously difficult thing to be able to do, and so when you do it well, and I think the appeal of golf, and I'm trying to figure out, because my original plan was to just, originally I wasn't going to do it, and then the friends talked me into keeping this as a journal, so I thought, okay, this is just going to be a diary of a bloodbath, basically, and I thought at the end of it, I'm going to quit golf the day I finish the book, and then, you know, have two things to celebrate. But it gets its hooks into you, because what happens, as you know, is you hit that one, usually right after a miserable day, you're playing terrible, and on 17th or the 18th hole, you hit that one golden shot, or you sink that one ludicrous putt that Tiger would have sunk from 40 right. feet away, and for the that'll keep you coming back for another year or two.
Right.
I mean, your brain, oh, I can do this.
And the game can embarrass anybody. I was telling Carl before the U.S. Open this year is being played at Torrey Pines, and the San Diego paper invited four prominent athletes from San Diego to play the U.S. Open course. I think it was yesterday, or it might have been a couple of days ago. You know, Tony Gwynn and Norv Turner and Phillip Rivers for the Chargers, and you know, it just brutalized. I mean, Gwynn, who's one of the greatest hitters of all time. You know, he shot 119.
Yeah.
You know, par is 72. So it's you know, it just shows.
But you see, that's a good example. Now here's a guy that made a career of hitting 100 mile an hour fastballs. It's a ball that's moving 100 miles an hour.
Right.
This stupid golf ball is sitting. It's not going anywhere. Right in front of you, and you can't hit it. I mean, that's about the sport. It's just nuts.
And the other thing I was thinking about, and you did mention it in your book, and I don't know if it was near the end, but it's like, you know, what if you would have gotten better? You know,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like it's not as good a book, is it?
But no.
You had to probably know going in that there was probably you weren't going to become a scratch player.
The odds were against me. I was never going to become a scratch player. I ended up playing at a level better than I did when I was a kid, but I put a little more time into it as well. But not much better. You know, in the game of golf, one or two strokes around isn't anything to celebrate. But it's true. The course of this is, I kept this diary. My editor at Random House is a hacker, and he may even be worse than I am. I never actually played with him, but I heard stories. But he would call up periodically for, like, progress reports, because I'd never done a book like this before, and I've never written a book in the first person or in the sense that it's somewhat autobiographical. And so he was a little nervous, and he would call me up, and he'd go, "How would it go today?" And I would, and it would be, you know, the worse I was playing, the happier he was on the other end. I mean, when he tried to sound sympathetic, I could tell he was full of it. He wasn't sympathetic. And I said, "Peter, let me just get this straight. Let me get the theory behind this book, because I'm beginning to get the feeling that the worse I play, the better you think the book is going to be." And he said something like, "Yeah, that's exactly the nature of our relationship. Basically, we want you to crash and burn." And I said, and so I became more determined to do better and better. And the more harder you try, and the more that it's at stake, the worse it got. So, but he was the one that came up with this idea. He said, "You know, this can't just be a diary. You have to set some goals for yourself." And I said, "Well, okay." One of the goals was I was going to try to break 88, which was the best I'd ever shot when I was a kid. It isn't very good, and I did that, I did it several times, and so I was, you know, I should have been happy with that. He said, "No, you got to do more. You got to play in a tournament." And I said, "You mean I've got to play with strangers?" And he said, "Oh yeah, you got to go out in a tournament and put your game on display for other people." And you know, writers are not ideally suited for golf anyway, because of the nature of our personalities is such that, you know, we're sort of cranky and solitary, and you spend all day in a room writing, and you come out and you just want to go somewhere and clean your brain out, and you don't really want to have to dress a certain way and observe a certain kind of etiquette, which you do on the golf course. There's things you cannot do on the golf course, and there's things theoretically you aren't supposed to say, and you know, and behaving well is not what we do best as writers. So it was already a challenge. Now the idea of it was horrifying to think of that I would go out and play. It was a club tournament, and it's called a member guest tournament. Every club has one where a member invites a guest or a friend of theirs, and they play these matches. In our case, we played 5 9-hole matches. And now there's something at stake. So my friend who I invited is a good golfer, and I thought, well, if even as terribly as I do, he can sort of carry the load, and I can just sort of be in the background. It doesn't work like that at all. So there was all this pressure, and that's sort of where the book kind of winds up in the end. It's just, I mean, I have one shining moment where I sink a putt and win one of the matches, and after that, it's just a comedy of incompetence. And I think, you know, a lesson learned. But the idea of really, you know, I'd forgotten that golf was supposed to be a social occasion. You know, you play in foursomes. I mean, I knew that, but I thought, well, I don't have to play. I can just go out and play all by myself, like late in the evening, and nobody will see me, and it'll be fine. But no, people are always roping you into, oh, I want you to meet my friend, and before you know it, you're with three strangers. And there's, for a writer, there's nothing.
You were petrified. I know, because you'd always try to get out there in the afternoon because you'd hope. You know,
yeah, nobody see, and in the courses, you know, there's a lot of wildlife on this course that I play, so you'd see gators, you'd see snakes, and it just was a nice walk if it didn't get ruined by the actual golf. But then the idea of, like, and there's a whole etiquette, guys bet, and you know, they like to bet, and I don't understand the betting in golf, so they would all say around, this is for this, $2, here's a press bet, I don't know what it is. I would just, at the end of these matches, just take out my wallet and just say, how much? And I did this one time, and my friend Lebo turns to me and says, we won. And I said, what do you mean we won? How could we possibly have won the way I played? And he hands me like $27. He says, just shut up and take the money. We won. That's how dim I am about the whole thing. I don't belong there.
And, you know, when you take up golf or when you take it up again, it's a commitment like no other. And I think this is one of the you know, best parts of the book is just – what it entails, and you know, and at first, I think you're smart. You say, well, I don't really want to go out and buy expensive clubs because, you know, it's almost like, well,
then you're committed. Getting a diamond ring for, you know, for your girlfriend. I mean, there's no going back.
So you buy, it's like you have the Jack Nicklaus.
Well, yeah, but I went into this secondhand store with my stepson. Because this was after I'd had this deceptive one little round of golf I played with an old high school friend. I didn't play horribly, and I thought, you know what, maybe I can get it back, and maybe I can actually get better at this. So I take Ryan with me. We go into some secondhand golf store, and I don't recognize any of the brands. I don't recognize anything because it's been so long, but I do know, I remember Jack Nicklaus. I have a memory of Jack Nicklaus, and his name is on a set of clubs, and I pick it up, and I take it to the guy at the register, and I said, "Will these fit me?" And he goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, perfect. They're perfect for you." So I buy the set. It's like the whole deal is like $169. I said, "This isn't bad. I mean, you know, really, that's not a bad way to get back into golf." And I go out and I start playing. Nothing is going right, so I go take a lesson. And the guy, the first thing he does after a couple swings, he says, "Can I take a look at those clubs?" I said, "Yeah, they're Jack Nicklaus clubs." He says, "Let me take a look at this." And the shafts of the drivers are like noodle, and he looks at me and he holds them up and he goes, he says these don't really fit you. I said, well, the guy said they fit me, and he said, he's trying to be nice. He goes, they're kind of for an older golfer. And I said, what do you mean, 70s, 80s? And he's going, yeah, in that area. I go, oh, I said, in other words, these clubs would be great for Mickey Rooney, but not for me. And he goes, exactly. So then I got to go out, and then I got to start investing in the real stuff, which is not cheap.
And that's the other part of golf. I mean, it's out to get you. I mean, the expense alone. I mean, and maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, the coming back to the sport and seeing all the new technology. I mean, it's mind numbing. Some of these types of clubs and weighted, clubs. And
well, once I started keeping this journal, I figured I had to do the journalistic research. So I got all the golf magazines, and then I started watching the Golf Channel. And then you see all these devices, and every month there's a new driver. And that's the most expensive club in the golf bag, as you probably know. And it's the one that most men in particular have trouble with. And I'm sure there are all kinds of Freudian reasons for this. But I know guys that have entire garages full of drivers that they've discarded because the drivers weren't working right. And as in many things in life, it's not the equipment, it's operator error. So I was onto the whole driver thing, but they get you with all the just picking out a golf ball. You know, when I was a kid, there were like two or three brands. There was like Wilson and a Cushnet or something. I mean, and these brands, now I can't find them. And now they have Nike, they have Noodle Balls, they have a million. And then you start reading up on the ball, and like they have a golf ball that has more than 1,000 dimples on it. 1,000 dimples on it. And this is a big selling point. And then, I'm looking at my golf. It's only got 392 dimples. And I'm thinking, oh, Jesus Christ. Well, I bet it'll go three times as far if I have 1,000. It has nothing to do with distance. Nothing whatsoever to do with distance. Everything that they try to sell you is some sort of, and so I started buying all the gadgets and they have this, the one thing I bought, and some of you may have actually purchased this thing called a Q-Link. It's a little plastic pendant that you put around your neck, and it has a special resonating cell in it to adjust your karma on the golf course. And it was endorsed by like three or four PGA guys. And a guy I knew actually showed me his Q-Link, and he said, you got to get one of these. Okay. So I call up the Q-Link people. I call up the website, and then I call up the Q-Link people. First thing he does, he tries to sell me, well, the one I wanted was just a plain plastic Q-Link. He wants to sell me the platinum, pure, the solid platinum for $899. And I said, no, I don't think. He said, well, we got gold. Gold's what's on sale today for $599. I said, I just want kind of the regular Q-Link, the one that so-and-so is wearing. I don't know which pro is wearing it in the commercial. He says, okay, we'll sell you that one. And so it arrives, and I look at this thing, and it's a little piece of leather and a piece of plastic. And I said, what the hell? And so I put it, like a moron, I put it on. I go out to the driving range. Nothing. I mean, it's just a disaster. The first few holes, I'm actually playing better. So I'm thinking, oh, man, they're. And then I thought, I'm not feeling any resonations. I'm not feeling my karma is screwed up as it always is. And so I gave it about a week, and then I won during one really particularly horrendous round, I think the 16th hole or something. I just tore it off my neck. But I didn't throw it away. I wanted to have a conversation with the Q-Link people because they had offered a refund. And I thought, I want to tell them exactly. So I go home, and I call the 800 number, and I say, I want to send my Q-Link back. And she goes, okay. And I said, let me tell you why. And I start to go through my round of golf with this woman on the other end to tell her every bad thing that had happened to me. She's not interested. She couldn't give a rat's ass. Not literally. No, she just cut me off. She said, just send it back, okay? Just send it back. We'll credit you. I said, but don't you want to hear about the shanks that I got? No. That's the end of it. I wanted some vengeance. I did nothing.
It's like the worst three words you can hear on late night television and watching the Golf Channel is three easy payments.
Yeah, I know, it's true.
Right?
Oh my God!
All right, let's talk about some of these other things. The mind drive.
Oh,
tell us about
the
mind
pills.
Drive.
Yeah, I see this ad. Yeah, I see this ad for these pills called Mind Drive pills, and to help you focus on the golf course. Mind Drive pills, and this is right before the tournament is coming up, and I'm thinking I need all the help I can get. So I call up the Mind Drive people, and they say, we'll be happy to send you some, but if you sign, we'll give you a discount. Well, a lifetime supply, and every month you'll get a pack of Mind Drive pills for the rest of your freaking life. Is this what you want? I said, no, let me try like a month's worth. So the pills come, I open them on the way to the golf course. I don't even read what's in them. But it looks like lawn cuttings. It looks like you literally somebody went behind a lawnmower and just filled up these little capsules, okay? So I'm popping the Mind Drive pills, and then not much is happening. Not much good is happening. I notice I'm sweating a lot. And I said, Jesus Christ, I'm not really playing any better. And then I keep losing them. I keep forgetting where I put them. That isn't a good sign for Mind Drive. You're not supposed to forget where you put them. So my wife says, "Did you ever check to see what was in those?" I said, "No, I didn't." And so I look at the box, and she says, "You know, you should Google some of this stuff." So the first thing I Google, the first one, which I can't even pronounce, I mention it in the book. I look it up, and it's on there, and it says it's a natural antidepressant. I think for golf, that's perfect. And so I eat more of them. That's what I need. Doesn't do anything.
I mean, you invested. I mean, the Radar golf system.
Radar balls. Yes.
Yeah, Radar balls. $200 for that.
That was embarrassing. Radar balls. I thought it was a joke, and they have balls that have radio chips in them. So if you hit them out of bounds, and then you carry this console with you, and you find the golf ball, and it is supposed to be good to within 100 feet, which is great if you only hit it 100 feet out of bounds. I was way. So I take it out on the golf course, and the guy I'm playing with, Mike Lupica, the Daily News, is just, he's mortified, because I turn this thing on, and the first thing it does, I hit this drive that goes, I hook it way over this hill. This is perfect. That was my mind drive ball. I turn it on. We're going to go find the ball. He goes, geez, and it starts beeping even before we get in the car, beep, 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 beep. And that's because I'd forgotten. I had all the other mind drive pills in my bag. And that's what it was reading. And you have a special insulated bag you're supposed to seal the other radar balls in. And now the whole thing's just, so I have to get rid of those. I'm all excited. We're cresting the hill, you know, and I'm ready. I've got this. And my ball's in plain view. It's not even lost. And the damn thing doesn't come on. It's right there. There's my ball. So I got that didn't work. That was the oh my god.
Visiball lenses.
No, I didn't go for the Visiball.
Oh, yeah.
No, that was where I drew the line at the Visiball lenses. Yeah. There was this ad, because now my friends are calling me because I'm buying all this crap. They're calling me and saying, "We found something for you. It's just what you need." You know, my so-called friend. So I get a call and it says, "Yeah, you got to check this ad out in the new Golf Digest for Visiball." I said, "What is it?" They said, "It's a special kind of golf ball. When you hit it into the rough, the heavy rough, you can see it even in the rough. You can see that it has a special Visiball, and you put on these glasses." It's like the ones you used to wear in the movie, you know, 3D. Like
3D.
And the ball becomes visible to you. And it's blue-tinted glasses. And I call it up, and there's this big warning. There's a big warning, a big disclaimer. And it says that these glasses are not to be worn for any other purpose except when looking for the golf ball. Do not wear them while driving. Do not wear them while at home. And I'm thinking, these are some kind of glasses. And so I read the whole thing, and I'm all set to buy them. And then you go on the website, and they have a graphic, a before and after. Find the ball without the Visiball special lenses, and then find it with the Visiball lens. And I look with my bare eyes. There's the damn ball right there. I said, "What the hell?" And then you turn to the Visiball thing, and it's just slightly more. I said, "No." So I call it. I'm not falling. I did not go for the Visiball. No, I didn't go for it. Bad product.
Now, there was an investment you made that really paid off.
Yes.
Although not in.
Oh yeah,
necessarily in golf, but the Momentous golf trainer.
Yes. Now, if any of you are golfers, you know one of the things they like you to do is you get a golf club that's weighted. It's a very heavy, heavy golf club, and you practice swinging with it to build up your muscles and to get your tempo, slow your swing down, and so a golfer named Fred Funk, who's a great golfer, and he's almost 50, by the way, so he's my hero. He was endorsing this Momentous swing trainer. And I went out, and so I ordered one, and it came. It's like a 7-iron, but it weighed 40 ounces, which is more than Barry Bonds' baseball bat weighs. And so I practiced with it a while, and it didn't do anything for my swing, nothing. So, I mean, my game is as usual. So I stuck it in a corner. I just put it in the corner and forgot about it. And this is in the book, and I know I'm going to get a lot of grief about this, but this is what really happened. We were renting a house, and my wife and I had stored some boxes in this shed right out by the back door. And she said, "Can you go get me the box?" Get them. So it was an empty box. She wanted to put something in. So I got there and I opened the box, and there's like 4 or 5 full-grown rats in the box. And it's me and the rats. And in Florida we have tremendous. We have rats the size of beagles. And they live in palm trees. They're palm rats, and they have big, long tails, and they literally come out of the trees. And I had a long and not a very good history with rodents. And because when as a kid I had snakes, and snakes eat rodents, so I had to collect rodents to feed to the snakes. So we had had a bad relationship going back generations. And then right before this happened, some rats had gotten into the undercarriage of my car and eaten out all the wiring, to over $2,000 worth of damage. So the rats love to eat the plastic off the wiring in your car, and then they eat the wires. And it just completely fried my whole air conditioning system. So now, in other words, I had a chip on my shoulder going into this about the rats. I wasn't objective about the rat. But I knew this, that, you know, the kids are in the house, and I've got these rats, there's a nest, and they're nesting. You know, you can see the nest. And so I had to make a decision what are you going to do, let them go? Well, I'll catch you later. No, I don't get that. I rush into the house, and the first thing that I see is the Fred Funk Momentous swing, 40 ounces. And I grab it, and I run back there, and I commence to go at the rats. Now, I cannot hit the ball when it's a golf ball sitting still, but I got to tell you, these are moving targets, and I did a number on those rats. I think I was batting about 750 on those rats by the time I went in. My wife came out. She saw this horrible commotion. Me and it wasn't a typical golf swing. You couldn't. It was more of a Lizzie Borden kind of motion that I was. And she came out with this, "What in the world are you doing?" And I just said, "Rats!" And she screamed. And just then, one of them jumped out of the box and headed straight for her. So she slammed the door. And that one got away. That one got away. The others did not get away. And there was this tableau in this quiet suburban Florida neighborhood of me in the front yard hosing blood and bones and fur off the Fred Funk Momentous. And to all the rat lovers out there, I usually have a two-word response: bubonic plague. Okay. Yeah. We still have to get even for that. That's my, but that was it didn't help my swing any, but I thought it would be a great endorsement. You know, if I call Golf Digest or something and say, you know, it doesn't work on your swing, but my God, it takes care of the rats in your life.
Well, as you're going through all this hilarity of trying to, get better at this game, there is an undercurrent. You mentioned earlier about, you know, why you played golf in the first place as a kid to get out of church. But, I mean, there's a relationship with your dad who died very young. But, you know, that's kind of the subtext of this book is there is that tug and learning from your dad and wanting to pass it on to your own kids.
Yeah, it was something I didn't anticipate because I thought, well, this is just going to be kind of a funny diary of a middle-aged guy being foolish. And I figured I deserved the same brutal treatment that my characters in my novels get from me, and I thought it was only fair. But they did ask me to, you know, the editor asked me to sort of go back in my history and explain why I ever got involved with a sport like this when I was obviously, you know, psychologically unfit for it. and it went back to my father, and so I ended up having to sort of reconnect with some of those memories, and because he was a very fine golfer, and he loved the sport. And when he was a kid, he used to, and this was back in the days when Fort Lauderdale was really just a village basically. And he would ride his bike 10 miles with the golf bag, literally hanging off his shoulder on his bike every day after school to practice golf. And he became very good at it, and he loved the sport dearly. And I think he wanted desperately for me to not only love the sport, but enjoy our afternoons together. And I was such a pill about it. I mean, I didn't have the temperament for it. I was hot-tempered. I was cranky and pouty when I hit a bad shot. And I think, so part of the book is my reflecting on, you know, that time that I felt wasted with him. I mean, if I'd known, you never know when you're going to lose a parent or something. And if I'd known he wasn't going to be around that long, I would have behaved better when I was out there. But I, you know.
Well, I wonder if maybe you can read it. There's a passage in the book about your dad.
Sure.
And I don't know if you want to read all of it or
yeah,
a portion
let me
of it,
a
or
at
maybe
it.
Pick it up at some point.
All right. Let me see. I'll read a little bit about. I'll just read you about talking about my dad, as I said, wanting to play with me. And I was acting like a jerk out there. And I'll read you a little bit about it. I said, although he wanted me to love the game as much as he did, we weren't wired the same way. I was impatient, hot-headed, and self-critical, the worst possible disposition for a golfer. Usually I'd pick up my ball before the round was done, and Dad would let me drive the cart the rest of the way. At that point, all the pressure was off, and I have wonderful memories of sitting at the wheel watching my father swing a driver with a sweet, fluid rhythm at which I could only marvel. Looking back on those weekends, I can't help but feel sorry for my mother, who was locked out of such an important part of her husband's world. She was a golf widow long before it became a cliché. Considering the arguments that took place in our house on Sunday mornings, Mom would seem an unlikely fan of the game. Yet she is. When I broke the news that I'd started playing golf again, she said it was a great idea. During my next visit, she gave me some black and white photographs of Dad that were taken by one of his aunts in the summer of 1942 when he was 16. In the pictures, he's tanned and lean, his hair blonde from the sun. One snapshot shows him blasting out of a bunker. In another, he's pitching to a green. There's also a backlit photo of him holding the pose after hitting a fairway iron, hands high, hips fully rotated, belt buckle square to the target. My father had one of the loveliest golf swings I've ever seen. Mom says the same thing. Although I'll never be able to play as well as he did, the photographs are a sentimental inspiration. They're tacked to the corkboard in my office, and they still are. And so, I mean, I had never seen those pictures of him before, and I'd never talked to my mom about it before, because part of the backstory there is that I was getting out of church on Sundays, and she felt this was a giant scam to go off and play golf with my dad. So the arguments on Sunday were my sisters and brother, why does Carl get to go play golf and we have to go to Mass? Not a good God versus golf argument is not a good one to have. So that's some of the backstory there on that. So and it sort of come full circle, because as I was getting to the end of this, you know, doing the tournament, finishing up right. the book, my kids, my 8-year-old in particular, really took a liking to. He'd asked to go to the golf course with me, and I got him a little set of clubs, and he loves to hit the ball, and my stepson started taking it up seriously, so up to the point where he made the golf team. Shockingly, it shows he doesn't have any of my DNA, but he's and the joy that they have out in the golf course, it really prevented me from quitting all over again, which was sort of my master plan, was to bail again, and I couldn't do it, because I thought back to the afternoons that I'd spent with my dad, and I wanted them to be good memories for my kids. And maybe also I would hope to absorb some of the sunny attitude that the kids have about the game. I mean, they hit a bad shot and they shrug or they laugh, and they just hit the next shot. And I've never been able to do that. I hit a bad shot, and I'm like all of a sudden Charlie Manson on the golf course. You know,
well, you know, things can go wrong on a golf course with the equipment, and it was an interesting point of the book where you have this passage about your father. And, you know, so you're reading it and you're kind of going, oh, that's... And then the next thing in the book is this story about your... it was Sandridge, right? The
Sandridge Country Club, yeah.
So I don't know if you have time to tell that story real quick about...
Well, I sunk this golf cart. Now, I assumed... I'd been away from the sport a long time. And I assumed, because this was a course that... There are two golf courses at Sandridge and Vero Beach, and one of them is called the Lakes, meaning lots of water, right? So I figure, okay, lots of people must sink golf carts. I thought, this is something they probably are equipped to deal with, because there's so much water out here. And I wasn't in the cart. I had parked the cart on the side of a hill, so my official story is that the brake failed. That's the one I'm sticking to. But I was walking down to the water hazard to retrieve an errant drive. And I was picking it up, and I heard a disconcerting sound behind me, and it was the sound of the golf cart coming down the hill and with no one at the wheel. And I said, and it hit the water with quite a splash. And I, you know, there was a moment where you think, okay, what do I do? Because it was a Florida lake, and, you know, there's certainly alligators, there's certainly water moccasins, there's natural elements to be considered. But I this is what brilliantly I do. So I go crashing in, I jump on the, like it was a stagecoach, I jump on the back of this thing as it's heading down the slope. I unbuckle my Callaways, and I heave them up onto the shoreline, heroically, and sort of ride this thing down to where it stops in the mud. And then, like a complete moron, I think, okay, I can drag this out. It only weighs, what, 1,500 pounds? I can drag this thing out. That's what every 53, 54-year-old guy should be doing. So I'm sitting there in the mud, up to my ass in the water, with my hands on the bumper. It didn't go all the way under. You could see the roof of it, and you could see the top of the steering wheel. Here's the other thing. I'd forgotten there are electrical components in a golf cart.
Right.
And so I'm reaching around. I'm hanging on there like some sort of gibbon, you know, on the animal planet. And I've got my foot on the accelerator, and I'm trying, and I shove the thing over to reverse, and bubbles are pouring out of the back of it, and it's not going backwards. And so I slog out of the lake, and I'm all wet. And my cell phone was in the bag, in the golf bag, so it was dry. And I called the pro shop, and I said, John, I got a problem. I sunk a cart. Could you guys? And I said, I'm sure this happens all the time. And there's just a silence on the other end. Because, you know, he goes, it really doesn't happen all the time. I said, well, do you have people that can come out and get the cart? He goes, well, not really, no. I said, how deep is it? And I said, well, you can see it. I said, you can see it. So they send the ranger and they send the starter out, and they each come in separate golf carts. And they trust me when I tell you, they didn't leap out to help me. They just sat there and they looked at the situation, and they said, "Did you try to?" He said, "We don't really want to leave it there because the neighborhood kids will come and pull it out and steal it." I said, "Well, I can't get it. They'll get it out. Why don't you go back in and see if you can't do something?" They're not coming in the water, by the way. So I get back in there and I'm fiddling around and with trying to get trying to find the accelerator pedal again, and then I hear one of them say to the other one, he says, "You know, he could probably get electrocuted out there right now." So that was, I was off the cart then. So now I take off my golf shoes and here's what I do. The guy says, I said, "Can I keep playing?" And he said, "Well, sure." I said, "I don't have my shoes are wet. I'm going to play barefoot. Do I get a demerit? I don't know what the etiquette is. You're not supposed to play in bare feet." He goes, "Yeah, we'll let it go." And he gives me his cart. And the last thing he says, and it's in the book, he goes, "Well, that one goes real slow. You aren't going to get in trouble with this one." I said, "It didn't do anything. I did the brake failed." Anyway, so I go on my merry way, and then the 9 holes of this particular course comes around the other side. And so I'm playing, and I'm not playing well. You can imagine. I'm a little bit rattled. And I come out to this tee, it's on the other side of the lake where the cart has been sunk, and there's a rescue operation in progress. They have like a four-wheel drive big Jeep Wagoneer backed up with a steel cable going into the water to the bumper of the cart, and they're pulling it out. And the humiliating fact, I mean,
you're the idiot factor is
yeah, I mean, here I am. Yeah, and I'm the cause of all this. They have like, it's like a whole crime scene. And I just, it was the most horrible and humiliating thing. And I said, everybody I played with, I said, "Haven't you ever sunk a cart?" "No, we never sunk a cart."
But the kicker, I mean, you're probably wondering when you're going to get the bill, right? And they kind of just
they cleaned it out. I just said, "Send me the bill." They cleaned it out and they got it working again. And the best part for me, I don't know how they did. It took several days. They finally called me and I said, "I'm happy to pay." He said, no, we'll take care of it." I said, "I said, what about the brake?" And he goes, "Yeah, the brake. They said there was something. The brake wasn't quite right." And I felt completely vindicated. But I think the guy might have also been just being polite and nice to me about it, because I think maybe I didn't set the brake the right way. But in any case, and that was a public course. And I thought, and my big question, I didn't know, can you get kicked off of a public course forever? Can you get 86th from a public golf course? I don't know.
I think so, for sinking a cart, I think.
Yeah, I think
probably the one. That's probably the thing.
Yeah, but see, now that, but there's another, in my view, it's another argument for playing golf alone. Because if I'd been with someone and they'd been in the cart and sitting in the passenger side and they weren't slower, they didn't get out in time, there could have been a real casualty.
I don't know how we're doing for time. I think we'll probably go to some questions and answers. There's a lot of other really good stuff in the book that we just can't get to. I mean, you know, shank, the word shank, which you refuse to use, and you know, it was when you hit a ball that goes this way, and
yeah, dead
and,
right.
And you write that, you know, the shank is to hackers what the clap is to porn stars, and that's so, but in the end, you do improve, you better your mark. I think it was your best round was 88, and you end up you shot an
85 a couple times, yeah, but never any better.
You get through the guest member, you have to play with people, and you survive that. And then you find out, I mean, you knew this all along, but I mean, you were trying to do this on a really tough course.
Yes.
I mean, they talk about, we'll get into stemp meters and stuff like that, but this is a major league course. And,
right.
You know, you probably could have found it. Probably
well, that, in retrospect, yeah, that was not really smart of me, because I didn't know what all these ratings are for golf courses. They have these very sophisticated ratings, slope and meters and all this kind of stuff. And to me, it was just it was a club where they accepted me. And I had to go with it because I didn't have a lot of offers, okay? And I thought, and I've said this before, I don't know why they took me, because I wouldn't have taken me. And this was the Vero Beach is still a pretty conservative area of Florida. And if they'd read any of my columns or read any of my novels, I thought I was screwed. There's no way I'm getting in. So we went to the course, went to the club, and my wife... It really was like kind of like one of the Larry David episodes. My wife, you said, okay, you're going to let me do the talking here, and you just be as nice as you can possibly be, and we'll just pray they haven't read anything you've ever written, okay? And maybe we'll get in, because they had a swimming pool the kids could use, and they had some tennis court. They had stuff she wanted to do, and she really didn't want me to screw it up by saying anything. So I was as nice and polite as I could be, and they let me in. And then later I find out that it's some Tom Fazio and Nick Price thing. It's impossibly, the best score ever on the course ever was shot by Nick Price of 68. He's a pretty good golfer, and so Lupica said it the best. He said, "You're trapped in an abusive relationship. Why are you on this golf course?" And here I was. So
yeah, but stemp. What was the stemp? 133, I think.
133 is the slope on the course, and the greens generally run. If you know anything about golf, they generally run about 12, which is like putting on this.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, it's just a built-in. If you like humiliation and self-debasement, it's perfect. Perfect for someone, for me, and that's. But they, you know, that's where I ended up. It probably was a good experience. I mean, writers love to suffer, so I think that's why.
You picked the perfect sport for that. So I think at this point, maybe we'll go into questions and answers.
Sure. Right? Yeah. I see the microphone hovering out there. Everyone's numb. For the rat stories, sort of put everybody off. I shouldn't have mentioned that. I know. Yeah. Yeah, I can see. Yeah, she's on her way.
Hi. I'm from a golf family in England, so I'm the only one who doesn't play golf, and so I sympathize. My husband now plays golf, but I have a question about your swamp psychopath that's been in a number of your novels.
The novels, yeah.
And is that based on someone you know?
You talking about Skink, the guy who lives in the ex-governor?
How did you find him?
That was really a product of my disturbing imagination. One of the selfish things when you're writing novels is you get to invent characters that you wish really existed. And I always wished that Florida was populated by a roadkill eating ex-governor who comes out and shoots up rental cars with tourists in them. And the truth is, that's every Floridian's fantasy. I mean, if the truth be known, every Floridian, if they said, "Oh, there's a sniper shooting at rental cars on the turnpike," they'd go, "Okay, all right." But nonetheless, that's where I wish that there are at least three different ex-governors of Florida who tell people that they were the model for that character, which just shows you how disconnected from reality these knuckleheads are. But no, he'll be back. Skink will be back, I'm sure. It's time. It's time. I mean, this is in this political year in particular. I mean, I just watching what's going on, and it looks like Florida is going to be in play again in some way. We thought we were off the hook when they said, "Oh, your vote's not going to count in the primary." And I wrote a column saying, "Well, thank God it's not going to count." we can finally relax and let someone else screw up the future of the republic for the next 8 years. And now thanks to all this, now they want to bring us, you know, it's so I think there's enough going on that he needs to come back. And I will say one thing, though, if you're a budding novelist, and I always tell people this, if you're an aspiring novelist, stay away from roadkill as a recurring theme in any of your books, because there's a whole cult in this country that I wasn't aware of. I sort of put it in there, as I thought, just as kind of a twisted affectation, but I didn't realize some people take their roadkill real seriously. They send you recipes, they write you letters, T-shirts, hats, slogans, and in one case, I was presented at a book signing with an oil painting of a roadkill, a little beaver or something. Someone worked very hard on it, and he presented it to me as a gift. And I thought, I've really tapped into a dangerous part of the American psyche here. Yes, sir. Oh, sir.
Who would be your?
I can repeat the question too.
What would be your ideal foursome to play in? Living people that we might know that you would find intriguing.
A foursome to play in? You know, I don't believe in foursomes, but if I had to play with three strangers, I'd love to play with Jack Nicholson. I think that would be a blast. And I think it would be entertaining. And I'm trying to think of who else would be fun to be. I mean, there's a lot of rock and roll people who play golf. I wouldn't mind playing. I mean, believe it or not, Bob Dylan plays golf. Now, I think of foursome where you have like Dylan and Dylan, Nicholson, and Cameron Diaz. I think that's my foursome. And I would ride in the cart. I would let Dylan and Nicholson ride in the cart together, and I would sacrifice and ride
Justin
in the cart
Timberlake.
With him. No, not Justin Timberlake. You know, he's a hell of a golfer, and I write about this. This is very disturbing to sort of a kid who grows up with classic rock, and you know, I mean, and you read every year, Golf Digest publishes a list of the 100 best like showbiz golfers and musicians and artists who golf, and like Justin Timberlake is like an incredible golfer, and I mean, he's in a boy band for God's sakes, and he just would kick my ass on the golf course. It would be more than I could possibly deal with. The shaving thing alone would make me nuts, I think. I think you should shave. I think you should be able to shave every day and have a beard. That, I mean, honestly, I don't think you should go out there dancing around. But he's a great golfer. He is a great golfer. There's a lot of really, Kenny G is a great golfer. And some of the best musician golfers are the country musicians. The country music stars are great golfers. I don't know why, but that's true. Yes. Yeah, you have to wait for the magic microphone. I'm sorry.
You talked a little bit about that herbal mix.
Yeah.
Did you have any other researchers in chemical enhancement?
No.
The stuff you find at the tea, I mean, like a bottle of 151 rum.
Yes.
A bong that somebody forgot.
I had friends who when they play golf, they bring about a 100-gallon igloo cooler full of Budweisers. But I can't. And they're very relaxed by like the third hole. They're incredibly relaxed.
One of the best golfers I know is Valium. He says it slows you down.
Valium. Yeah. Well, I'm going to confess something. Before the first time I had to play with a foursome, and when I came back to golf, I popped a Xanax, and it was like it didn't do anything. It was like a Tums. It did nothing for me. I was so nervous. I took a Xanax because that's what I take before I get on an airplane. I'll confess to you, I'm not a big fan of airplane travel. So I thought, well, if it helps me get through a bumpy airplane flight, surely a round of golf didn't do a damn thing for me. But and I've had friends in college. I mean, I remember days at the University of Florida walking the course where there was distinctly in the air the aroma of something natural, drifting from fairway to fairway, and there was some of the happiest golfers you've ever seen. But nothing works. Let me just say that nothing works for me, okay? No, then absolutely nothing.
Have you found that a very relaxed attitude toward the rules is helpful? Sort of like to...
Well, I can't. I have to obey the rules. And I read the USGA rule book. And there's an example of this in the book. In the book, I hit a drive that's so far into the woods that it lands in a pile of raccoon crap, okay? Now, you're wondering, how do I know it's raccoon crap? I'll tell you how. I actually I actually raised two little raccoons, and I'm familiar with their crap, okay? I know right away what it is. And so I say, the only guy who can stand to be with me on the golf course is this caddy, Delroy, who is like my spiritual advisor and my therapist, and he just and my warden and everything. And I said, Delroy, what's the ruling on raccoon poop? What's the ruling? He goes, I don't know. And I said, I'm afraid to take a drop. What if it's wrong and I get, you know, do I move it or I don't move it? And he said, I would just go ahead and hit out of it. I mean, he wasn't going to touch the ball. That's for damn sure. I said, all right. So I hit out of the raccoon crap. I used a 7-iron, got out fine. But I got home that night, and I rushed to the USG, because I'm new at this, and I figure I better look it up, because I didn't want to have like a score with an asterisk if I'd done something wrong, you know, when I file your handicap online. And I look it up, and I look up crap. I look up all the common, and there's nothing and nothing. And finally, I get to like loose impediments. And then they list all the loose impediments. And I think the last one in there was dung, I think, or something like that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, dung. I was thrilled because I'd done the right thing. But I mean, it was a desperate move. I'm sitting there going through, there's got to be something, because animals are all over the golf course. There's got to be a ruling on it. It's not something you're ever going to see happen at like Augusta during the middle of the Masters. You're not going to see Tiger calling the official over going, saying, hey, look at that, I'm in a pile of raccoon crap. What do I do? But that's the sort of insane length that I took of the rules, because I wanted it to be, I did want it to be fair, and I wanted to be on the same. I mean, some people play very loose. You know, some of our former chief executives are fanatical golfers. One of them is William Jefferson Clinton. And if you've ever talked to anyone who's played golf with Bill Clinton, there's a saying, when you play golf, you know this, you get a mulligan or something. Like usually on the first tee, early in the morning, you hit a bad shot, they say, take a mulligan. And then your first one's sort of free, and then you hit the ball. Clinton has like a floating mulligan, according to Jack Nicklaus. Anytime he hits a bad shot, he gets another one free. The ball tends to move out of the rough on its own. It leaps out of the rough. It jumps out of the bunker. Clinton, you got to watch the guy the whole time. The whole time when you play with him, apparently. So, I mean, but there is a true, I think, I don't know, Chris, you've probably heard this before. I mean, that golf is one of these games that really does sort of hold a mirror up to your soul. I mean, in the sense that how you behave under the worst situation on the golf course tells a lot about your character.
And guys will, and it just happened a couple weeks ago in a tournament. It might have been at the Masters. There was an amateur that called a, you know, his ball moved a little bit, you know, when you're on the putting surface. And a lot of these guys will call penalties on themselves when no one else saw it.
No one else saw it,
That's kind of the code of the...
I did that to myself. And I was playing by myself, and but Delroy was there, of course. And I had a chance to break 90, you know, which at the time I wasn't doing very often. And I stood up and I put the putter down behind the ball, and it was a real windy day. And I didn't touch the ball, but the ball moved. And I turned to Delroy and said, the ball moved. I got to call it on myself. And he says, yeah, you do. And so I didn't break 90 because of that. But I know that sounds insane, but that's part of this honor of the going back to Scotland, that you there's no referees, there's no umpires out there, there's nobody but you. And you, if you're going to lie when you're playing by yourself, I could have said I shot 78, nobody would have known the difference. You know, that nobody's going to know. So you just do it. Yes, ma'am. Right there.
And you talked about sharing golf with your father and your children, and I just want you to know that for years, literally for years, my father and I have shared so much laughter talking about Boodle from Sick Puppy.
Thank you. Thank you. The book says, that's a sick book, too. They're all kind of, as I reflect on it, my poor mother, you know, she didn't really raise me to do this. And when these books come out, and there are certain scenes in the books that I have to kind of pray that my mom, I mean, she's a good sport. She always claims to have read the book, but my sisters tell me later, she didn't get that far. She's pretty.
Thanks for coming. I know a vegan who eats roadkill.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
And, what is that? How does that jive with the vegetarian life?
I don't know, but
I like that.
What I wanted to ask you is, you have a wedding ring on.
Yeah.
What does your wife have to say about all this golf?
Well, I'll tell you, the most disturbing phone call I got during the whole my so-called comeback was towards the end of the journal when I was getting to the point where I was going to play in this tournament and everything, and I get a call on the cell phone, and she says, guess where I'm going? And I said, where are you going? She goes, I'm going to have my first golf lesson. And, you can't imagine the dangers to a marriage that this presents, because, first of all, you've got one partner in the marriage who is a crappy golfer and is mad at himself the whole time, and now you've got, and she was being a good sport about it, and she said, I'm going to have a golf lesson. I said, well, good, honey. And I pretended like this was the best news I'd ever heard, when in fact, so I immediately start calling my friends who have of two minds. One of them said, oh, this is great. You guys can go to the course together. And I said, you've seen me out in the course. Are you out of your mind? Who's going to want – she's not going to want to be a – and then David Faraday is at CBS, a great golf commentator. He's a friend of mine. He just sent me a two-word email and said, you're doomed. That's it. And so she – but she got some clubs, and she does go out, and she hits on the range. She likes to sit there and hit the ball as hard as she can on the range, and which worries me a little bit. She seems to, and it usually is connected with some behavior of mine, where she's going to the range today, and so I'm imagining as she's looking at the ball, what she's really thinking. But she actually likes it, and she also kind of enjoys it out there because the kids are out there too. But golf is very time consuming, as you know. I mean, it's a whole day really to play, and so you have to carve out the time to do it, and you know, if it's one of your days off and you're away from the family, it can cause a little friction at home, and so I try to sort of bring everybody into the experience, but with me it's not something they would really rather go to the dentist most of the time. Okay, yes. I'm sorry, it's coming.
I have a two-part question. It's
okay.
Kind of related. How many golf clubs have you broken?
Oh.
And how far can you throw a 7-iron?
Well, I haven't broken any. I'm going to say honestly, I haven't broken any clubs, and I will find that I can throw the clubs. I can't throw the clubs as far in my 50s as I could when I was 17 and 18. That's one thing I have noticed, is I can't quite get the distance on a rotating 7-iron. I try not to do this because apparently they frown on this behavior on this club I'm at. But my wife was with me one time. She was driving the cart, and she parks next. And I go into this bunker, and it's a real steep bunker. She can't see me. And of course the ball doesn't come out, but my sandwich comes flying out, and she says, Jesus Christ, and she drives around the other, she thinks something's bad's happened to me. I just had flubbed the shot and threw the sandwich, and she really wished she wasn't there at that point. Yeah, it's not, I really have tried to be better about that, destruction of equipment, partly because the equipment is expensive. It really is, you know, it's not cheap to destroy a good golf club. I mean, and the golf balls themselves aren't cheap anymore either. So that's another thing. If you hit a lot of them into the water, it's very painful. It can be a very expensive day out there. We have time for, you want me to do one more? Okay. Oh, way over here, sure. The mic's done. I'll repeat the question.
Your favorite book. What would you say is your favorite book?
Of the ones I've written? Mm-hmm. That's a tough one, and I always say the same thing. It's like asking somebody, which of your kids do you like the best? And sometimes you love them all dearly, but sometimes there are times when you don't. And I think for sentimental reasons, probably Tourist Season, because it was really the first one I had done on my own, and I thought it was a miracle that it got published. Just the storyline alone, I thought it was amazing that they published a book about, you know, a group of kind of bumbling terrorists that were killing off tourists for fun, basically. And I thought, if I can get this published, I can get anything published. And I did. The very next book was about sex and murder on the professional bass fishing circuit. And so, I mean, what it did was it told me that anything was possible. Anything. The world, the literary world opened up to me based on the fact that, but, you know, because when you have an editor in New York who, and I did, a great guy, Neil Niren at the time, he didn't know very much about Florida. He had relatives in Florida. Everybody has relatives in Florida, but he had some. But he didn't really know the real Florida the way I did, so that when I sent him this proposal, he was sort of perplexed about the whole thing. And then the opening, right in the beginning of the book, a Shriner gets bumped off. This group of miscreants kidnaps a Shriner right before the Orange Bowl parade. When we had an Orange Bowl parade, the Shriners would always have a big, they run around, the little cars going in circles. But I handled it extremely tastefully. I had all you see is this. He was at the beach with his family, and all you see is the empty fez at the waterline with the waves lapping over. I mean, the violence wasn't on camera, as it were, but it was just that scene. And I thought, and I think that's one kneel. That's what one kneel over. He thought this has possibilities. It was a real literary moment there. And it went downhill from there, obviously. But that was still I probably sentimentally always be my favorite book. But and thank you all for putting up with this. And thank you, Chris, for the good question.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.